This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following Rustic Exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 34 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winston. And today, we're going as late in the timeline as we ever have in Greetings from Allentown, all the way to 1999. And it would have been a cliche if I had said we're going to party like it's 1999. I always got confused of whether that was supposed to be played on New Year's Eve 1998 or New Year's Eve 1999. I believe it was 1999 into 2000. I mean, at least that would make sense. Anywho, 1999 WWF today, the WWF Halftime Heat Show from January 31st, 1999. Now, this is more than just the empty arena match between The Rock and Mankind. This was a full Sunday night heat show with the match for the world title tacked on at the end, and along with the Super Bowl commercial that the WWF purchased and aired on the broadcast of Super Bowl 33, which aired on Fox here in the United States, which is kind of interesting in that the WWF had last aired on network television in the United States on the Fox network all the way back in 1992 for those last couple of Saturday Night Main Events that didn't feel like all the other Saturday Night Main Events because NBC had their own way of doing things and the Fox ones just had a different feel, even beyond just the 1 hour length of the program, whereas NBC had an hour and a half. But that's in the past. Let me just get to some quick plugs before we get started here. You can reach me on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. You can reach me via email, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. And of course, you are probably listening to this show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, which is very closely associated with the Place to Be Nation. Go visit Place to Be Nation for some articles of writing wrestling history. I mentioned the Jason Greenhouse article a few weeks back about 1987 Royal Rumble, imagining how that would have gone down in retrospect, what that match would have looked like if that pay-per-view had actually happened in January of 87, how Andre might have turned in that case. So do check that out and participate in the discussions there. They are put up on a weekly basis on Sunday via, I think it's a Discus chat, whatever it is. And they do have a live watch of pay-per-views on Sunday nights that they kind of informally gather together and organize. I think right now, because I'm actually recording this on Sunday night, they are watching the In Your House Bad Blood from October of 1997. And of course, for your Amazon shopping, if you want to support Place to Be Nation in a different way, you can go to placetobenation.com/Amazon, just as I did earlier today, or no, it was actually yesterday, I guess, as I record this, where I bought 5 bags of coffee from Tim Hortons because I am just an addict and I can't get enough. And as it turned out, Amazon lowered the price of those little bags. Of course, they won't lower the price of the 32-ounce cans or the 34-ounce cans, whatever the size is on those, because God forbid, you know, they sell to people who are not in part of that Amazon Prime pantry. I know Amazon is our friends here, but I just can't get down with this Prime pantry thing because I would have to order like 20 cans of coffee to fill the pantry box. Maybe I just need to look into that. I don't know. I'll have some time later, so I should probably just do that. So 1999 WWF, in retrospect, it was quite an interesting time, and it's not an easy time to go back and watch. I was 19 and 20 years old that year. I turned 20 in April of that year, And when you go back, and of course, you know, it's famous for being the year that had, oh, highest rated segments and this and that kind of stuff. And WCW was kind of going down the tubes as the year went along in various ways, but I'm not going to get into that because maybe someday I'll cover a 1999 WCW show, despite the fact that it would probably turn my brain, it would do to my brain like a computer getting the blue screen of death. That is probably what would do it, and I would lapse into a coma or something like that. But the WWF in 1999, while it was exciting in the moment, and you know, when you're a 19 or 20-year-old guy back then, you look at it differently than being 38 years old and looking back, and you're a different kind of wrestling fan, and you appreciate, you know, a match and how it's put together. And of course, Monday Night Raw back then, or Raw is War / The War Zone, as it was known at that point, which they put the kibosh on that following the September 11th attacks in 2011, because that name really wasn't going to fly from that point forward. The matches are all like 3 or 4 minutes, and we'll get a glimpse of that on this show, as this is all done at a Raw taping, because SmackDown would not come until later in the year. Heat was this second show that was created, with the first episode airing on August 2nd, 1998, which I did not watch at the time. It was on the USA Network, and it eventually moved to MTV when Spike / TNN / the National Network / whatever the hell you want to call them, when they picked it up, they moved it to MTV. I did not watch that initial episode because I know exactly where I was on that night, and that was at the Heatwave pay-per-view run by ECW out in Dayton, Ohio. And that'll be a fun story if I ever get around to telling that, and how a guy from the northern suburbs of Boston ended up attending a pay-per-view 775 miles from his house when he's just working at a pet store on a weekly basis. That was kind of one of the more interesting weeks of my life. But Heat was a B show that eventually became a C show, as these things tend to go. It's not going to be on par with a Monday Night Raw. The same way SmackDown and Raw, they try to present them as equals over time, and if SmackDown is the better show, well, of course it's going to be downgraded, just as it was in that 2004, 2005, 2006 era, and just as it was after SmackDown was really good for much of 2016, it's been pretty, well, I don't want to say awful, but certainly not as good. The emphasis has definitely gone towards Raw this year. Back to 1999, it's such an interesting time because the top of the card is so stacked. You have Austin, you have Rock, you have Mick Foley at pretty much the height of his powers in January of 1999, at least from, you know, a pop culture perspective, I guess. But Austin really wasn't around as much as you might remember from 99. Yes, he does win the title at WrestleMania from The Rock, but he loses it back to Undertaker in that awful Over the Edge show that, of course, Owen Hart fell to his death during. It was just kind of a weird decision to change the world title given what had happened on that show. But late in 98 and early in 1999, Austin was really not even on TV. In fact, he's obviously in the Royal Rumble, which I'll get to that in a bit, because that was 1 week before this show aired. But on the Raw before this Sunday Night Heat from January 25th, he's not there except for a promo on the Titantron at the beginning where they say he's in San Antonio, Texas, oddly enough, hanging out at what looks to be a bar area with Shawn Michaels, which may or may not be the best idea in the world. I don't know. You can't judge. You can't judge. And obviously the biggest reason for Austin kind of being shunted to the side was because of his obvious health issues, nothing to do with his 55 knee braces that he had on at all times. It was obviously because of his neck, which would, of course, put him out later in 1999 for pretty much the entire course of the next year, where he only made a sporadic appearance, because the famous one at Backlash 2000. So Mick Foley, as Mankind, kind of steps in to that vacuum and doesn't become the top baby face there, but kind of assumes the mantle. He's think of him as sort of like a pitcher who came out of the bullpen, and I swear to God the baseball references are probably going to end soon because the season is pretty much over. But Austin is an ace pitcher, and he hurts his arm, and Mankind comes in from the bullpen and throws 6 shutout innings. And that's pretty much what he did here against The Rock all through the course of January. Of course, the famous thing was the Raw at the beginning of the month on January 4th, where he won the title on a taped Raw, which I attended, by the way, in Worcester, Massachusetts. And I just remember thinking through that whole match that they aren't going to change the world title on a taped Raw. That's just not going to happen, which only added to the shock value of it. And then, of course, it ended up burning WCW because Schiavone goes and mentions the title change. And, well, we all know the story there. But, of course, you get the finger poke of doom on the WCW show at the same time. So it's just kind of like a one-night snapshot of how WCW was trending down and the WWF was trending up. It was that month, and this month we're talking about here, January 1999, where the WWF pretty much pulled away for good. And that's in spite of the fact that, as I mentioned before, the Royal Rumble was truly a hideous match. It was built entirely around Austin and McMahon being numbers 1 and 2 in the match. And it was not one of, in fact, I consider it the worst Royal Rumble until the year 2015. And then I want to talk about why 2015 was bad. But this particular one was, you have the guys in at 1 and 2, and you have the little confrontation early on. And then they go away for a while. And Austin gets attacked in the bathroom, and you have Vince going on commentary like he's the Miz or something like that, and they're just out of the match. And that kills me when I watch these Royal Rumble matches. And I love the Royal Rumble as a concept. You know, I've reviewed all the ones that I actually care about. Yes, I have not done 2003 through 2013 on my blog, but I have actually, you know, watched them at the very least. It just kind of took me out of the moment of like, okay, well, why doesn't everybody just come to the ring and then just stand on the outside and we'll all just have a jack-off session and just do it that way? I mean, what is the point? What are we doing here? Yes, I know you're trying to create a storyline here, but what it did, it had the effect of making pretty much everybody in that match look like a complete jabroni, as The Rock would be fond of saying during this time period. I mean, I remember I used to do the 3 stars of each Royal Rumble, where I would kind of, you know, hand out, you know, whatever. The first star would be the best guy in the match, and so on and so forth. I think D'Lo Brown was my number one star in the 1999 Royal Rumble, which ought to tell you, that's not a knock on D'Lo Brown, but I pretty much gave him the number one star because he frog splashed Steve Austin, and I just freaked out at a mid-carder performing his finisher on 1999 Steve Austin. Also on that Royal Rumble was the infamous I Quit match between The Rock and Mankind. Mankind, the defending WWF champion in that match, where, of course, it is immortalized in the documentary film Beyond the Mat, which I have on DVD somewhere, and I probably should bust it out and watch it at some point soon, just really for my own edification. Plus, there's a whole lot of Terry Funk there, and you know how I feel about that. Of course, it's very difficult to watch that match because of the sheer number of chair shots to Mick Foley's head. And Foley goes over it in his book, where he kind of expresses dismay, or his dismay at that point, towards The Rock for just kind of not protecting him in any sort of way. Now, as for head injuries back then, there's all this talk, you know, especially with the NFL now and CTE, and I don't really feel qualified to weigh in on that. But what I do feel qualified to weigh in on is what we felt at the time in terms of head injuries. We knew that if you hit a guy in the head enough times, we knew that concussions existed. There were guys who missed time because of concussions. Eric Lindros in the National Hockey League missed a ton of time mainly because he skated with his head down most of the time and left himself vulnerable to getting hit in the head, even though he was a bigger guy. When he would have his head down, he would leave himself open to that. In fact, his brother, Brett Lindros, retired from professional hockey after only about 2 years. He was a mid-first-round pick, and he retired, I think, at the age of 20. It Jim McMahon, who got slammed to the ground by Charles Davis at one point, one of the Green Bay Packers, one of the most notorious cheap shots, at least in the 1980s NFL. And that was a cheap shot even for then. So we knew that head injuries existed. I think the difference between now and then, or at least the biggest difference, is the fact that back then, I think people thought that maybe if you gave people time to heal from head injuries, that the brain could somehow heal itself. But that's not the case, as we know now. If you take 10 chair shots to the head, that is just going to make things worse. And it doesn't matter if you sit out 3, 4, 5 weeks or whatever. Or in Mick Foley's case, this empty arena match is taped 2 days after that Royal Rumble match, which is incredibly irresponsible, but even, I think, for that time period. But, you know, it's just one of those things where you had pressure put on you, and not only in wrestling, because Mick Foley knew that he probably had a limited window to make as much money as he could, but back then in any sport, whether it be football or whatever, if you had a concussion, you were really encouraged to get back out there as soon as possible. The health of the athlete wasn't put first, which of course is something that in professional wrestling has been just notorious for not looking out for the wrestler's well-being. Now, of course, WWE is very, very scared to even let, say, Daniel Bryan wrestle to the point where he had to announce his retirement. So you had the I Quit match at the Royal Rumble. Before that, you had a regular match on Raw that was a complete schmoz, really kind of a microcosm of 1999 WWF. Even though it was taped in 1998, it was certainly a glimpse of what we were going to get a whole big dose of going forward. So this match, the empty arena match, is something that there is not an extensive history on. In fact, for some reason, I had it in my head that Memphis and down in Texas, that they used to have these things all the time. And it really wasn't the case, at least in terms of high-profile empty arena matches. The most famous being in the early 80s with Jerry Lawler in Memphis facing Terry Funk, where they fight all over the arena, and Lawler ends up winning de facto, not via pinfall or whatever, when Terry Funk gets an object stuck in his eye and starts yelling about his eye. Funk would bring the match to Championship Wrestling from Florida the next year and kind of modify it slightly, where it was an empty arena, bunkhouse, a lot of different stipulations in that one. But on a big stage, this would be the next empty arena match that we would see. And since then, I guess TNA did a Sting versus Kurt Angle empty arena match in 2009. And then, of course, there was a long series of empty arena matches that is commonly known as Global Force Wrestling tapings. And the man behind those is actually on this program as Jeff Jarrett, who had just won one half of the WWF World Tag Team titles alongside Owen Hart. He is facing off against the Big Boss Man, which Nothing says 1999 WWF quite like a heel versus heel matchup. But, oh wait, don't worry. If you like that, there's a second one as Ken Shamrock, the Intercontinental Champion and former Tag Team Champion with the Big Boss Man, he is actually taking on Owen Hart. So we're getting one-on-one rematches of the Tag Team title switch that had taken place on that January 25th Raw. Of course, this Shamrock-Owen match, it calls back a little bit to the SummerSlam 1998 Lion's Den match, and then of course the dungeon match that they had had the month before on the Fully Loaded pay-per-view. So that's enough of the table setting. Why don't we just jump right into the show? A little round here. The show opens with a brief review of what has happened recently with The Rock and Mankind, and then you have Kevin Kelly, who is the announcer on Heat, alongside Shane McMahon, who I'm going to have quite a bit to say about in the matches that he calls coming up here. And they throw it to Michael Cole, who was on the call on Monday Night Raw at that point in time because Jim Ross had his bout with Bell's Palsy, which was, I think, the second major round that he had. And to think about that one was particularly sad because, of course, he had the attack on a pay-per-view that was taking place in the United Kingdom, as he was calling it, and also his mother had just passed away at the time. I can't imagine the kind of grief he was going through. And you're not going to get any mocking of the Bell's Palsy from me because the Oklahoma thing kind of, it takes a lot to really sort of offend me, but that character kind of offended me, and it really didn't offend me so much as my father actually had Bell's Palsy at one point in time in 1993. It was actually before Jim Ross had Bell's Palsy. Luckily, my dad's case was a relatively minor thing, and it was resolved, I think, within about 9 or 10 weeks, something like that, which is something Jim Ross was not so lucky with. And there are not too many people in the public eye who have had Bell's Palsy. The only other one I can really think of offhand is a pro golfer by the name of D.A. Weibring. So other than that, I really don't know. So Jim Ross is out of commission from that point up until his return at WrestleMania, or there was that heel turn somewhere in there, but who knows when the hell that was. So Michael Cole, as he is now, is on the call, but they throw to him, he's in the empty arena, and he looks kind of sad and kind of serious at the same time. He glumly explains that Vince McMahon, and not he, nor Kevin Kelly, will be calling the empty arena match.
In just a few moments, this arena will be emptied of everyone. The only people inside will be WWF owner Mr. McMahon, who will serve as the guest commentator for this matchup.
You'll get nothing and like it.
So there was a very good reason why Vince McMahon put himself on the call of the empty arena match that would air at halftime of the Super Bowl. And even though Jim Ross was not there, I think that even if he was healthy and available, I don't think Vince McMahon would have used him. I mean, think of all the various ways that Vince McMahon has tried to get rid of Jim Ross through the years. And yes, Jim Ross was very good during 1998 on Raw, and he was an important part of the package. But I'll get into the reasons why I think Vince McMahon would have chosen himself to call that match over JR when we get into the match itself. There's one particular moment that really just kind of stands out. So we get Shane McMahon here, and of course, as we know, he was gone for a very long time and inexplicably came back in 2016 to say that he wanted to control Monday Night Raw, and they set up the match against The Undertaker at WrestleMania 32 for control of Monday Night Raw, which Shane lost, so then they just gave him SmackDown anyway. Just another example of why the storylines in today's WWE is not something I can particularly go along with. But back then, of course, he didn't have Here Comes the Money or any of that stuff. And then the No Chance in Hell thing for Vince was effectively brand new at that time, because No Chance in Hell was kind of a tagline for the 1999 Royal Rumble. Instead, Shane comes out to something that sort of looks like a weird offshoot, or sounds like a weird offshoot of the Jake the Snake Roberts babyface music from the late 80s and early 90s. And the corporation is here to celebrate the induction of China into the corporation. Now, of course, I recently saw the list of Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame, like the ballot for it. Now, I am not a fan of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame, because it is a Hall of Fame that contains Chris Benoit, a guy who murdered his wife and young son while an active wrestler. And yeah, I know they put him in 2003, but, you know, they could have kicked him out and not made it 60% of the vote to kick him out. And in fact, 60% of the people should have voted to kick him out. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. So China, on that ballot, is actually listed as a non-wrestler, from what I saw, which I thought was really strange, because she most certainly wrestled, but I guess she was on the outside maybe for a longer period than that. And she had turned on the previous Raw, January 25th. She got the heel or face turn of the night, for it seemed that every single week somebody was going in one direction or another, or you had somebody jumping from one show or another. So that was the big thing on that night, where The Rock and Triple H had an I Quit match that is just so classic for the way it was booked for Triple H. I mean, you want to talk about Triple H using political maneuverings to get himself favored later on. Here, he loses an I Quit match by saying, "I quit," as he's about to pedigree Rock on a table, because members of the corporation had come down and had kind of held China in a light hostage situation, is the best way I could describe it. So they said, "Kane is going to choke slam or give her the ride or whatever if you don't say I quit." So Hunter says I quit, and it's all over, and he makes his way into the ring. And China, of course, a low blow, yet another staple of 1999 WWF. That is how she cements her turn there. And what we have here is another one of those late 90s things where you have this huge oversized stable. In WCW, of course, it was the NWO, and here it is the corporation, which just seemed to expand at an alarming rate, taking in people like Ken Shamrock, who maybe didn't necessarily need to be a part of that whole thing. And it was the usual where you had one person talk, and then the amusing thing of, like, you had all these other people in the ring, and they just sort of had to mill around, like, not really listening, but kind of sort of maybe half paying attention to what was going on. And this is not exactly playing to China's strengths here. This is not somebody at that time that maybe you wanted to throw out there and have them speak in the ring extemporaneously for 2 or 3 minutes. But she does get in what she has to say, although her voice isn't exactly the most pleasing when it hits the ear. I mean, let's face it here. And she basically just gives her reasons for why she would leave DX.
"Well, well, well. What do you know? The opportunity to talk. Because that's what it's all about, guys. Right? Opportunity. We all want to get ahead."
I'll spare you the China porn jokes, at least for now.
"DX wanted to get ahead. You know how they did it? Me. I was the force behind DX. Because I carried those four degenerates on my back for almost 2 years. But you know what? Even though I did that, where's my gratification? What did they do for me? Let me answer that. Not a damn thing."
Let me put on the kayfabe hat again. I haven't done that in a while. Just to kind of examine that whole point from that perspective. Now, I am of the belief that, you know, China helped Triple H a lot more than he might have helped her. And of course, God knows what happened later certainly did not help her in any way. But of course, she was mainly given a platform to be in DX. And there was not a lot of spots for somebody like her to kind of show up in. There was no women's division to speak of for over a year from the point that she got there. So she was going to have to be a valet of some kind, and she didn't have the looks of a Sunny or a Sable, so she couldn't appeal from that perspective. So it was a very limited sort of thing, but she fit into it perfectly. And she undoubtedly elevated Triple H from kind of ordinary mid-carder up into maybe an upper mid-carder, I would say. Certainly not a true main eventer, because otherwise they wouldn't have had that horrible push at the end of 1999 where they would do absolutely everything and anything to get him to that next level. But of course, she became a star as a part of it, but I think it was mainly because of the platform and nothing. It could have been any heel faction where she's serving as the muscle. I think she would have become a star out of that, mainly because of how unique she was. So I'm going to say that I sympathize with her here from a kayfabe perspective, and that she was actually correct that she did a lot for them, interfering in matches, and she never got a chance to talk. Now, granted, her voice is probably a huge part of the reason why here. And, of course, what happens next is DX interrupts because, you know, after all, she is talking here. And we get China sucks chants from the crowd, and little did they know how true that would be about 10 years later, various nights in China and all that. So, and of course, the Triple H kind of goes in on her in kind of like a weird sort of way, in my opinion.
I don't think anybody knows China better than Triple H.
China, you wanted to be treated like an equal, and we did it. The problem was, we never were equals, because the fact of the matter is, the four of us are men. And no matter how bad you wanted a set, you could never get them.
Well, that's really unenlightened. I mean, it's a good thing that he married Stephanie McMahon, who, as we all know, invented women's wrestling as we know it, because All Japan Women's in the 90s, that was also Stephanie McMahon as well. She started the All Japan Women's Revolution. I believe she was in her crib at the time that she did that.
For you, it's all about the money, because you're nothing but a $2.
Now, that's definitely not true, calling her a $2 whore, which of course gets bleeped because Sunday Night Heat was under some sort of different restrictions in terms of language than Raw and Warzone were. Of course, they would push a lot of the racier stuff into Warzone at 10 p.m., and kind of explain it that way. But as for her being a $2 whore, I disagree there. Let me read from an article from 2011. Neither Laura, Joni Laura, China of course, nor her lawyer would discuss the payment she received for her performance in Backdoor to China, which, as its name obliquely indicates, features her engaging in anal sex. Both she and Hirsch indicated that Lauer had received a fee for her performance and will also share profits with Vivid under the agreement. So clearly not a $2 whore. I'm pretty sure that it was somewhere in the neighborhood of well over $5, $6. I'm just kidding. I don't know what she would have gotten there. But it's a little kind of direct there by Triple H. It's like, oh, so hilarious, like the hypocrisy and like the things that he was allowed to do to get over. I mean, it was just this. Can you imagine if they allowed Roman Reigns to do the same things that Triple H had done over the last 3 years? I mean, who knows? Maybe things would have turned out differently for the people who boo him on a regular basis. And this language thing on Sunday Night Heat is they bring it up again when X-Pac, he's very upset with Shane. And, of course, they would go on and face each other at WrestleMania down the line. And Shane had Bronco busted him a week earlier. And X-Pac gets a little too excited at the end of his promo. And of all people, it's the Road Dogg who has to step in and be the voice of reason.
I'm going to take that silver spoon out of your mouth and I'm going to shove it straight up your...
Wait. This is heat. You can't say that on heat.
I'm pretty sure that X-Pac has said a lot of things on certain things. Heat wouldn't be the name of one of them, but I can think of other terms, maybe like speed or whatever. But he seems to be on the straight and narrow now, at least from interviews that I've heard from him recently. So that is good to hear. I don't mean to make light of it or anything, but, you know, I mean, look at the era that we're in. I mean, with what they're saying, they're just asking me to say these things. And for this, they're setting up a match between Triple H and Corporate Kane, which just makes me laugh because it just takes me back to 2014 WWE, where Corporate Kane, unmasked, of course, at that point, coming to the ring all the time to lose on Monday night to John Cena or whoever. It felt like he was losing truly on a weekly basis. Well, here he would lose on the following Monday in a steel cage match against Triple H that featured a lot of shenanigans and interference. And Kane would eventually end up teaming up with X-Pac later in the year in kind of a weird weird duo there. As Kane, this was the era of he's free of the Undertaker. So the question with Kane when that whole thing started is, what is he going to do after the Undertaker thing ends? Because when you think about the Undertaker's opponents over time, Kamala, Bundy, Giant Gonzalez, these guys were not really around much longer after they faced the Undertaker. So something needed to be in place given the great buildup for Kane. Hopefully something that would be as successful as it was for Mankind in his feud with the Undertaker, because he was one of the first ones to really kind of come out the other side unscathed. And here, he's part of the corporation, and he doesn't want to be a part of it, but they're going to take him back to the Nut House for reasons that I haven't been able to quite figure out, but they were just trying to put him in a home or whatever, like he was Grandpa Simpson. And that is Kane in 1999, coming out the other side of the Undertaker feud and chugging along, which he would somehow manage to do for the next decade and a half. That's some damn staying power.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Puri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Right before their ad break, they showed Mankind getting out of a comically small, I don't know, maybe not comically small, but a two-door hatchback, which he took to the arena. He was given a ride by somebody. And that always reminds me, I love the stories of not necessarily old-timey wrestlers, but I'm thinking in particular, Foley in his book goes through this, and also stories about Owen Hart, where they act extremely cheap in order to save as much money for their families. And, you know, because they're quote-unquote independent contractors, you do what you have to do because medical care for your family and insurance, even back then, was still not exactly the cheapest thing in the world. So as I said, Jeff Jarrett is now one half of the tag team champions, having won it from Boss Man and Ken Shamrock alongside Owen Hart. So it's Jeff Jarrett versus the Big Boss Man in a heel versus heel match here. And as I said, there's nothing more 1999 WWF than completely smearing the line between face and heel. And it would seem that Jeff Jarrett is the de facto babyface, which works well enough when you're in Memphis, Tennessee, but everywhere else in his career as a babyface, it just has not really worked out, at least in my opinion. Although 1998 was a good turning point for Jarrett, I will say that for him, when he got rid of the ridiculous long hairdo, which made him look like something out of the 1980s, and getting the short hair at that point. Unfortunately, that led us to the Snapnuts. What the hell am I getting that from? Slapnuts era of Jeff Jarrett, where he's just hitting people with guitars and never drawing a dime, or so the legend goes. But the Big Boss Man, and I've talked about him on more than one occasion on this show. I covered his debut television match with the WWF from 1988, and his highest profile, most watched match, which of course would be the main event in 1989, where he was one half of the Twin Towers. Here he comes back in late 1998 as a completely different guy. After floundering in WCW for a while, trying to find the right name, the boss, the guardian angel, any sort of law enforcement thing you could find. And before he just finally, they give up and they say, all right, you're going to be Ray Trailer. So he just goes under his real name, which was a very WCW thing to do in the mid to late 90s. But he wasn't doing much of anything there. So he comes back in the fall of 1998, a completely evolved man. And I expressed my love for the Big Boss Man outfit. That is some solid costume designing by them. But also, don't sleep on how good the Boss Man outfit is in 1998 for this run into 99 and 2000, because they changed it with the times. And I was very impressed at how well that came off. You could argue that the outfit from his 80s and 90s run is a little bit maybe cartoony. Here, he's not so much a prison guard anymore. That's all in the past. Now he's more of like a security guard officer for hire, which seems like a natural career move for a guy who was a prison guard in the past. And he's sort of the hired gun of the corporation, and he debuted actually attacking Steve Austin. And while the music was certainly different and didn't have the kooky little tune like he had as the Cobb County prison guard, I did enjoy the Boss Man's music in the late 90s with the da-na-na-na, because it made sense with his continuing evolution. Actually, maybe evolution is the wrong word, because when I look at the Big Boss Man in 1998 and 99, I'm seeing the proto, the original member of the Shield, because he's wearing the full SWAT team gear and all that, and he's swinging the nightstick around like he's, you know, kind of doing a trick there. It always reminds me of the time I was in the Fitzgerald Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. There was a ad that would play when I would stay at the old Fitzgerald Hotel. I think it's now called The D or something like that, which is kind of a weird name. And there was always a fat guy twirling. They would show like an ad for the bar, and there was a fat guy twirling a bottle of vodka or a tequila or whatever as kind of like a trick. That would always kind of remind me of what the Boss Man would do with the nightstick. And he would do that in this run and would do it in the previous run. And yeah, that music also evokes the Shield as well, which of course wouldn't happen for over a decade later. So you have Jarrett, who kind of annoys me, and you have the new Big Boss Man here. But the story of this match, which is mostly punch kick, is Shane McMahon as a broadcaster, and poor Kevin Kelly, because I think he's pretty good in the few times that they let him call matches in the WWF in the late 90s. And I have not watched much Ring of Honor, but, you know, it's been perfectly fine, the episodes of it that I have been able to watch. Shane McMahon next to him is so goddamn annoying at all times. It's like your friend who took a, you know, who took a speedball or an eight ball of cocaine or something and is just out of his freaking mind. It's like Dick Graham without the charm. You know, Dick Graham is the Philadelphia announcer that you would see on the Spectrum shows all through the 1980s, who would constantly go, oh, and woo! You know, that was his basic commentary throughout the matches. But Shane, not only is he doing that, he's just going a mile a minute, and the broadcast just can't breathe at all.
Oh, China, the China syndrome. Oh, maybe we'll see China here in a little bit.
Now, don't worry, I'm not going to go into a long, extended talk about nuclear power just because he said the words China syndrome. And of course, that being a movie in 1979 that I've mentioned on the show in the past. I save my nuclear talk only for atom bomb matches, I can assure you.
There you go, Boss Man. Boss Man is fired up. Boom! Nice shot on Jared. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, baby. Boom! Boss Man's looking fierce. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, that's only the first half of this very brief match that I'm playing clips of Shane McMahon. So just think about sitting through an entire hour of Sunday Night Heat, where Shane McMahon, as the color guy, is talking 80% of the time and constantly interrupting Kevin Kelly. Look, I know the wrestling was certainly de-emphasized in favor of other things, but my God, I mean, no wonder why things were so much harder to follow and how this stuff isn't so rewatchable, because you just don't get any sort of narrative for what's going on because you have a complete nutcase who might be high on cocaine just constantly shouting over the play-by-play guy for the entire match. So as for the match itself, it's perfectly fine, But there's so many punches in this that there's really not a whole lot going on. There's a spine buster by the Boss Man, which makes it makes you remember the old Big Boss Man, but I only give it 6 arns out of 10 for that one. Debra, who of course is accompanying Jeff Jarrett at this time, gets up on the apron to distract, and the Boss Man was a little bit infatuated with Debra at this time, but this one doesn't work, and Boss Man just nails Jarrett with the sidewalk slam, which had kind of a spin rotation to it. I thought that was a pretty cool way that Jarrett took the move there, and he picks up the 1-2-3 there, so a small measure of revenge for losing the tag team titles. And the Boss Man decides to chase off Debra, who is wearing a short skirt that is incomprehensibly small. Like, I don't know how she can walk around without her, you know, kind of sticking out or whatever there. And Boss Man chases her out and hits Jarrett with the nightstick. And Shane just continues to make things really unbearable and not in a heel announcer way. We know what a heel announcer is supposed to sound like. Either he's supposed to be comically digging at guys like a Bobby Heenan, or just advocating in a much more subtle way, like a Jesse Ventura. Of course, anything would be more subtle than what Shane McMahon is doing here. He's suffocating this little 4-minute match here. I feel it's appropriate to play that particular Will Smith song, which was out around this time, because The Rock arrives in the limo with Vince McMahon. But I actually have a story about that song that kind of has to do with my own life at Boston University, although it was a year before this show would have been. My freshman year, and especially my first semester at Boston University, and maybe I'll go into this in more detail another time, and I've referenced my roommate who I had almost nothing in common with. He was a Jewish kid from the suburbs, the Tony suburbs of Miami, Florida. He kind of was a much more dark-skinned guy, probably got a little too much sunlight, which might have been part of his problem. Almost immediately, I gave him the derisive nickname Chico. Now, he reminded me probably more of Razor Ramon than he did of Tito Santana, but of course that is an homage to Jesse Ventura constantly calling Tito Santana Chico. So I called him Chico in referencing him to my friends, to the point where I'm not even sure what his actual first name was. So anywho, he got busted for marijuana at one point in November and got in trouble there, and they brought me in for questioning as if I was smoking the weed or whatever, and I had an alibi that I was at a Boston Bruins Dallas Stars game and even produced the ticket stub to the guy, and the guy was like, all right, get lost, whatever. So this album comes out November 1997, Big Willie Style, which is Will Smith's first solo effort, so bye-bye, DJ Jazzy Jeff. You're on your own now. And so he buys the album, and he brings it back to the room. And of course, as I said, he's from the northern suburbs of Miami. So he puts on the album, and he's listening to it, and I think this is like the 8th track on it. And Will Smith gets to that verse, and he's like, he has this reaction, like, oh, kind of like, you know, from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, like, whoa, like the look on his face. And he marches down the hallway and tells this other kid, hey, Mark, check it out. He's talking about Miami. And I'll just never forget the way he said that. Like, he's talking about Miami, as if Miami is freaking Dubuque, Iowa or something. It's not like, you know, he's from Grand Forks, North Dakota, and is mentioning that. Miami, Florida is kind of a big freaking deal. It is a warm weather city that has a beach where celebrities flock to. It is not a big deal. It drove me absolutely crazy. And I've mentioned that he did get thrown out of housing in April. So I did get the last month of the year to myself. But yeah, believe it or not, the guy who does a wrestling podcast at age 38 all by himself in his house, he actually had a hard time relating to people when he went to college 20 years ago. I know, that's a great shock. I hope you were sitting down for that one. Anyway, you got Ken Shamrock here. He's facing off against Owen Hart. And as I said, this is not exactly going to live up to their Lion's Den and Dungeon matches from the previous summer. In fact, earlier on, when I was taking a break between segments recording this podcast, I happened to, you know, just watch the Dungeon match from Fully Loaded, and I remember enjoying it the first time I saw it, but this time I really enjoyed that match because of how unique it was with the setting and all that. And the Lion's Den match, which was done at the old Felt Forum, now known as the Theater at Madison Square Garden, that's a very good idea as well because it actually drew people into, I mean, they were going to sell out the Garden for SummerSlam 1998 anyway, but now you're giving something to the overflow crowd that is in the theater there. And that was just really unique. If you're going to try and capitalize on the side popularity of UFC among a certain segment of wrestling fans, that's probably the way to do it. Not by doing a brawl for all that was a complete cluster F from the word go. And who better than Shamrock and Owen to truly make that thing look good? Although it was kind of funny, like, watching them have, like, this quote-unquote real fight in the dungeon and in the Lion's Den where they're going for Irish whips and doing Hurricane Ranas. It was just kind of a nice little wrestling interlude in the middle of a, you know, what was being presented as a real fight. So that was their real rivalry, but here they are again, and they are both heels again, because, you know, God knows we cannot have a babyface wrestling on this show, at least, you know, in the ring. This is during Ken Shamrock's Ryan Shamrock phase, when his quote-unquote sister was involved with Val Venus, and they had just made the film Sister Act, or Shaving Ryan's Privates, or whatever. Now, if you want to know why wrestling only commands 10% of the ad revenue of a comparably rated show, I think you can point the finger at the Val Venus character there. Now, granted, of course, at the time, oh, this is funny, a porn star, you know, it was the time where we were impeaching the president for getting a blowjob, amongst other things. But still, that character is so well remembered that, you know, a lot of people who think of wrestling from that time will think of that porn star character. So that's what Shamrock was kind of up to on the side here. And Owen is still wearing his it's time for a change gear from his time in the Nation, which a lot of people wonder why the hell was Owen Hart in the Nation when it was a group of African-American men, and then you had Owen Hart, a white guy from Calgary, Alberta. Well, of course, he was presenting himself as the Black Hart. So that, it all made sense. It all tied together if you really think about it. It's interesting to hear Kevin Kelly talking about how they'll cut to halftime heat if they need to. Like, they will cut away from this match because they needed to time it. So, because you don't know exactly when the Super Bowl is going to go to halftime. Yeah, you can make a nice approximation based on previous Super Bowls, and it's usually about an hour and 25, hour and a half for a normal regular season game. But of course, Super Bowl being very different with extra commercials, everything just kind of gets stretched out. It's like a four hour and 15 minute football game as opposed to the usual three hour and 15 minute game. So I don't know exactly the timing of halftime of Super Bowl 33, but they got this entire match in, and I'm glad, because even though it's not a good match, at least there were actual wrestling moves being done here. You have Shamrock tries to suplex Owen from the ring to the outside, which always sets up the reversal, and Owen executes that. You get the spinning heel kick, which is legally mandated in all Owen Hart matches, along with the gut-wrench suplex, something I recall him doing even in his Blue Blazer days. And I'm talking the Blue Blazer of 1988, not the unfortunate iteration we would get during this time in 1999. But he gets caught because he was wearing his shirt, and Owen executes the sleeper, but not with his arms, more with the t-shirt that he had had on earlier. But Shamrock uses a jawbreaker to get out of that one. But Owen catches the leg and lands a belly-to-back suplex. Shamrock regains control, but you get a low blow by Owen. I know, yes, we have to be reminded every so often that it's 1999 WWF in the middle of this actual wrestling match. And it was the mule kick for the low blow. Owen tries the enziguri, but Shamrock ducks out of the way, so he avoids that one, and he lands a back elbow as they go to a commercial. And it's at that point that I'm wondering if perhaps this tape match was clipped in some way where they let them go longer for the live audience and then clipped it down so as to time it with the halftime heat match. Then out of nowhere, Ken Shamrock blows me away by nailing a what I'm going to call a Frankensteiner, because it was close enough, versus a Hurricanrana, and that's off an Irish whip, which 63% of all offense in WWF 1999 was generated off an Irish whip. But we have the black-blue blazer running down to the ring. And yes, that is the former high-energy partner of Owen Hart, the Hall of Famer Coco Beware. And he runs down, and he had been interfering in matches, helping them win the tag title, Jarrett and Owen, that is. But something seems very off here. It seems incredibly mistimed, like Coco was hungover or something. And Shamrock has Owen in a belly-to-belly position for what seems like a very long time as the Black Blazer gets up on the top rope and sets himself. And Owen is just whipped into the ropes. Coco the Blazer slips and crotches himself on the rope, and then we get a belly-to-belly suplex for the win for Ken Shamrock. So, you know, this was just kind of typical fare, but at the very least, we were able to see some actual wrestling on the show. Owen definitely did everything he could do here. But, you know, it was, like I said, it was nice to see some wrestling on the show, because what we're about to see with The Rock and Mankind coming up next was incredibly different, in a different kind of match altogether. Different kind of match.
I would swallow my pride, I would choke on the rinds, but the lack thereof would leave me empty inside. Swallow my doubt, turn it inside out, find nothing but faith in nothing. Wanna put my tender heart in a blender, watch it spin round to a beautiful oblivion.
Rudy Poo. That's my way of paying tribute to The Rock, and I guess obliquely Iceman King Parsons, who, of course, a star in the 1980s in World Class, and even into the 90s in Global Wrestling Federation, who kind of made famous the phrase Rudy Poo before The Rock brought it to a national level. So since they're playing off football here, what they do is they have two helmets fall from the sky in a little graphic here, and both of them say WWF Heat on them, so I guess the WWF Heat is playing the WWF Heat here on Halftime Heat, is the thing that I guess they're trying to get across. But really, the old Monday Night Football intro from the late 90s and even well before that, you'd see the two helmets of the teams, and they would drop down and then they would smash into each other, probably causing CTE to the non-existent head that was inside. And that's the way with the explosions and all that. So, you know, playing off the Denver Broncos Atlanta Falcons Super Bowl that day, which was a relatively non-eventful game, other than that it turned out to be John Elway's last NFL game as he retired after winning back-to-back Super Bowls. And then there was Eugene Robinson of the Atlanta Falcons, who got busted with a hooker shortly before the Super Bowl. This seemed like the era of guys getting in trouble right before Super Bowl games. It kind of went back to the late 80s when you had Stanley Wilson of the Cincinnati Bengals found with a bunch of drugs. And that really hurt the Bengals in that ball game because he was their third down back, and they were really they never put the ball in the end zone, the Bengals. They only scored their only touchdown in Super Bowl 23 via a kickoff return, oddly enough, because Stanley Wilson was one of their kickoff returners. So, yeah, Atlanta, they were a 14-2 team there, but going against Denver, the defending champion, it almost seemed like it was fait accompli for John Elway to end his career going out on top. And that was, it was one of those days where, one of those Mary Lou Henner days, and she's that actress who was on 60 Minutes a few years ago for her bizarre, and it's weird that I'm calling it bizarre because I have a weird memory for all sorts of minute details, but they could ask her what she had for lunch on May 21st, 1977, and she could tell you, and, you know, what condiments and whatnot. Now, granted, she could be making it up, but probably not, because who would go to that lengths and have that as their gimmick? But on January 31st, 1999, I know exactly what I did. I know where I watched this. I know what I did beforehand, because it was particularly memorable because I have been to over, I was trying to estimate this and do the quick math, over 600 NHL games in my life, because I've had season tickets for the Bruins for a very long time here in Boston. And in fact, I even had season tickets for the Washington Capitals when I lived in the D.C. area between 2001 and 2003, a.k.a. the Jaromir Jagr era for the Washington Capitals. So I've seen a lot of hockey over the years. I can remember, you know, great games that I've seen. And that game on January 31st, 1999, was not one of them. In fact, I consider that, and it stood out in my mind, as one of the most boring games I have ever attended in my life. And looking at the box score now, it was, and this can't happen in today's NHL, a 0-0 tie between the Boston Bruins and the Carolina Hurricanes at the then Fleet Center, where the two goaltenders are Byron Defoe, who was supremely underrated during that time period, and Trevor Kidd in net for the Carolina Hurricanes. So yes, no goals scored in this game. But, you know, I've seen plenty of games that were very low scoring and were wildly exciting. 2011 Eastern Conference Final Game 7 was a 1-0 game and was the most well-played hockey game I've ever seen. But this one featured 5 different obstruction penalties, which is what they called interference. For some reason, they didn't want to call interference in the NHL back then. And it was just a slog of an afternoon game. I think they started at like 12 noon so that people could get home in time to watch the Super Bowl or whatever. So I go back to my dorm at BU, and then I head over to Loretto Hall, which isn't even a Boston University dorm. They had put Boston University students in Loretto Hall, which is kind of off campus because it was on the, actually, it was on the campus of Emmanuel College. So we had a friend who was there, and somehow, some way, this freshman that I knew, I'm a sophomore, we take our group, the Boston University Wrestling Federation, and we head over there and we watched the Super Bowl over there, and of course, halftime heat as well. And that is, of course, where we would watch Monday Nitro and Raw during that time period, because in the dorms, we did not have cable television. There were only 2 dorms with cable. And in 1998-99, he was the only one, the fella in Loretto Hall, that was lucky enough to actually have cable. So we would commandeer the TV in like the kind of ground floor area, and we'd have to smuggle in a whole bunch of people. So a lot of fun watching this match there. And I know that we popped as a group for some of the various comedy spots. And there's a lot of comedy in this match. And I can see why it might not be for everyone. But you gotta understand... Oh, shoot. I don't want to turn into Vince Russo here. All I want to say is that this match had a completely different purpose than to, say, advance a storyline. Yes, you have Mick Foley. He's, you know, walking around with his bandaged head saying, 7 days ago at the Royal Rumble, when, as I mentioned, it was actually 2 days since he took all those chair shots. And now he's walking around and he's going to have a match here. This is an effort to sell the WWF to an audience that maybe hadn't seen it before. On the day of the Super Bowl, wrestling was hot around this time. It was, you were more likely to have people that were going to change the channel to this and perhaps expose wrestling to people who hadn't seen it in a long time, maybe somebody who hadn't been watching at all. And you wanted to put in a comedic element here in order to help draw those people in. And that's also, I think, why Vince is calling it Solo, because we all know that he's an incredible control freak in the ear of the announcers and this and that kind of stuff. And that's his right as the owner of the company for 3.5 decades now. And because he is the long-term owner of the company, he has every right, I guess, as I put my palm to my forehead here, to allow his son to be on screen and to talk and to just generally be an annoying prick. I'll just get right into the match here. And even more interesting, the match, which does start in the ring, oddly enough, you know, for an empty arena match, you figure they would just meet on the floor or whatever, is, as I said, Vince is very, very different here. Yes, he is introduced as Mr. McMahon, but he's kind of like a straight-laced announcer. He's not the cartoonish Vince that you would hear on Raw and Superstars earlier in the 90s. He's not being over the top, unlike his godforsaken son here. In fact, when Mankind goes for Sacco early in the match, you know, so used to McMahon degrading Sacco and all that and making fun of it. But no, instead he plays it straight, and it's because he's simply selling the product here. As they head outside, you get something bleeped. And again, that's another one of those Sunday Night Heat gets a different rating or whatever than the Monday Night Raw. I do like how Vince is yelling at them as they're outside the ring to, quote, keep it in the ring. It's an empty arena match, Vince.
Come on, what is... Keep this in the ring. Keep it in the ring.
Mankind lets Vince know that he's going to be next, although that's really kind of the extent of Mr. McMahon's involvement in this match, is just sort of a bystander calling the match. Mankind gets thrown through the barricade, so now they are into the crowd, and he is thrown over 4 rows of chairs, and The Rock kind of starts covering him in chairs like you're sprinkling cheese on your pasta. Vince is a little bit starting to morph into Shane at this point.
Yeah, get him, Rock. Cover him. Get him.
The Rock says one chair for the good time. How about The Rock says maybe even two? How's that feel, huh?
And this is where the Rock comedy show really starts kicking into next gear. And it was a huge thing here in order to, of course, sell the product. And I really think that this match did more for the Rock as an entity in terms of propelling him in the public consciousness, because he's so hilarious. He gets a little overconfident, though, as he grabs the headset and ends up getting caught.
Finally, halftime, Super Bowl. The Rock, the great one, the most electrifying man in sports entertainment today. If you smell what The Rock is cooking. Now, I'll tell you what Mankind can do. What?
Oh. interesting thing here, as Vince says that Austin was supposed to do commentary with him for this match, but that he chickened out. I've never heard anything that might have been a plan or whatever, but honestly, I think it was for the best that you didn't have Vince and Austin overshadowing the actual match itself, because it would have taken a lot of the oxygen out of the room, so to speak. So Rock and Mankind, they head up the aisleway into the stands here, and this is the exact moment where we get the truly hard sell from Vince McMahon to somebody who maybe hadn't watched wrestling since the mid-1980s of why they should come back into the tent and why the World Wrestling Federation is worthy of your time.
Those of you just tuning in might say, what the hell am I watching? What you're watching is history in the making, the first time ever empty arena match for the WWF title here in the World Wrestling Federation. But more than that, you're watching action-adventure. That's what the WWF is. Soap opera. It's Roadrunner. Elements of One Life to Live. It's like Hollywood and Broadway and all points in between. There is nothing quite like the World Wrestling Federation on television. They're the number one ranked television show in all of cable television. And it's coming up, ladies and gentlemen, tomorrow night at 9 o'clock on USA. It's something called Raw is War.
And that is why, even if Jim Ross was healthy and able to do this, that Vince McMahon would have done this match anyway, basically for that 30 or 40 seconds of selling his own product that he owns and operates. I don't think he would have trusted anybody else to do that. But what's hilarious is, as he's selling the product there, there's actually a little scroll across the bottom of the screen, because it's, I guess because of the timing or whatever, it may have run into other programming, and it lets us know that the movie Fried Green Tomatoes will air as scheduled following this edition of Professional Wrestling. I thought that was just magnificent. Now, as for the Raw the following night, that did a 5.9 rating, which was the highest Raw up to that point, at least during the competitive Monday Night Wars. And I'm pretty sure that without looking it up, that they didn't draw a 5.9 at any point from January of 93 up through September of 1995. So suffice it to say that Vince's efforts made somewhat of a little bit of a difference here. I think it ticked up about a half rating point from the week before. And it's a good thing he got it in at this point, because the Raw the following week on February 8th was the annual preemption for the Westminster Kennel Dog Show. Rock kicks Mankind down the stairs, and Foley is just kind of rolling down the stairs and eventually stops. Rock says that Mankind looks like 10 pounds of monkey crap in a 5-pound bag. Well, I don't know how you would fit that. So now they end up moving around here. They go down, and they go into the kitchen. And this is the part that I really like, because they start working in the food elements into the cotton candy. And this allows Rock to really show his personality.
A little cotton candy, you probably like that. $5 for cotton candy, $5. You probably won't pay it anyway.
Prices they get in arenas these days.
Gotta love Vince complaining about the high price of concessions at sports arenas in 1999. It's like, yeah, come to a Boston Bruins game where they're getting $13.50 for beer. Although the Canadian listeners probably weigh in, and they're getting like probably 17, 18 Canadian dollars for a beer at one of the arenas up there, if you can even get in there. So now Rock takes a giant bag of popcorn, which probably weighs about 1.5 pounds. And this is one of the comedic things that I think Foley talked about in his first book, where he and Owen Hart would do these things where to sell like the most ridiculous item. And of course, popcorn would be the most ridiculous. So Rock hits him with popcorn and Foley sells it, which looks ridiculous, I guess, maybe to a casual viewer, but for somebody who's watched wrestling, I mean, you can't help but laugh at something like that. So now Foley has Socko on, and The Rock takes him over to the oven and asks him if he wants to smell what The Rock is cooking, and puts Socko in the oven, which presumably is on here for the purposes of what they're trying to accomplish. And Mankind ends up screaming and all that. And they move along down the line here, and Foley is falling all over the place, legs akimbo and just running into pots and pans and all sorts of stuff. Rock comes upon a bottle of Jack Daniels and decides to sing a little tune.
Jack Daniels, if you please, knock him to his knees.
There's something truly funny about a guy who is half black who is singing a David Allan Coe song. And if you know anything about David Allan Coe, look up some of his history on race relations. I'm not going to get too far into that because that's quite a rabbit hole. Now we enter the part of the program where The Rock is getting a little, he's getting a little peckish. He's had a little bit of Jack Daniels, so he needs to get some food in him. So he tries out some of the popcorn, and he registers a complaint about the about the popcorn they're serving at that arena in Tucson.
Too much salt!
Usually the problem with popcorn, in my experience, is that you've had to put a little bit of salt on it. So it is kind of unusual that that's a little different, although maybe they used the little jar and were a little heavy-handed. But now we get to the part of the match that I will remember forever. Of course, it is degenerated into a food fight down by the buffet table there. And Mankind gets some sauce to the eye there. And I've always assumed that it was salsa, but I guess it might have been spaghetti sauce. It's not really important. I've just always had in my head that it was salsa. So The Rock picks up something from the table. We can't exactly see what it is. And he actually dips it on Foley's eye, apparently, and registers a complaint with the sauce.
And it appears as though Mankind got some sauce in his eye.
It's mild, you don't!
So from that point forward, anytime I'm at a party and I dip a chip and The Rock does say that it's picante sauce. I can now hear him say that, you know, in prepping up the clip and everything. Every time I dip a chip at a party, and if the salsa is mild, I'm always, if I don't vocalize it, I'm thinking in my head, it's mild! Foley gets backdropped over the table of food, and it's just a mess there. The Rock picks up what appears to be a yellow squash, and exclaims that he doesn't know what that is.
Rock doesn't even know what that stands for.
Nasty looking squash.
Usually on this show, I cover a lot of squash matches and not matches that have actual squash in them. Anyway, Rock gets a beer and he drinks a little bit of it, and I guess he channeled his inner Austin there and dumped the rest of it on Mankind. He didn't really have anything to say about that. I noticed earlier with the Jack Daniels, Vince had said that the liquor has never touched The Rock's lips, which I don't know if that was a thing where he was, because of drinking on television, was a little bit different. I don't know the exact rules regarding drinking hard liquor on television. So he said that that was not real liquor for whatever reason. I thought that was kind of weird. They make their way into an office now in the building, and I don't know whose office this is, but they just kind of come careening in, and now you get a comedic bit where the phone in the office just so happens to ring, and The Rock answers the phone.
Hello? Oh, well, what do you know? How convenient. The phone's ringing. Yeah, smack down the channel. That's right. Well, no, Mankind's not available right now. He's a little busy. His mouth is full with The Rock's foot in his mouth.
That's great, because I haven't gotten a good Vince laugh in a while. So clearly the person, because this is how it makes sense. The person calling is a little bit confused about this guy who answers the phone, SmackDown Hotel. So they immediately call back the number, and The Rock picks up again and has an even better joke this time.
Plays in an empty arena. Balls count anywhere.
Balls ring again. What do you say? SmackDown Hotel, if you want to know your old book, Bar Jabroni Drive.
So they make their way out to the hallway now, as he had the phone cord around Mankind's neck. And this is where Vince once again, because time is running a little low, they've been tracking how much time was left in the halftime of the Super Bowl in the corner. And in case you're wondering what the halftime show of Super Bowl 33 actually was, it was entitled A Celebration of Soul, Salsa, and Swing, featuring Stevie Wonder, Gloria Estefan, and Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, not to be confused with the Big Bad Booty Daddy, Scott Steiner. Vince goes into the hard sell once again, basically his closing argument. But this one is more centered around The Rock and elevating him in this space.
The Rock with a great sense of humor. That's what makes him who he is.
Now, the unfortunate thing after that whole little bit is that The Rock then fat shames the woman who got trapped in the room there and tells her to get to steppin'. So, you know, things happen in the heat of the moment here. They make their way out into the hallway. They cut back into the arena where Kevin Kelly and Shane McMahon are looking at a monitor and pretending like it's being piped into the arena, which it's not. It's kind of a weird thing because they're in the filled arena for the Heat taping and all that, and the empty arena match is going on. Heat, I believe, was actually taped at the Raw the night before in Phoenix. So they're looking at the monitor, and you can tell that nothing is on the monitor because of all the people behind Kevin Kelly and Shane. Nobody is sneaking a peek at what's going on. They're effectively just kind of pantomiming. And they did this earlier on, and it was kind of weird looking back if you understand the production of it. And they make their way out, and we're getting close to the finish here with the loading dock area. There is a guy sitting in a forklift. Now, Rock lays in the mandible claw and lays the Rock out on the cement floor there in front of the forklift. The guy is just kind of sitting in the forklift. I'm not exactly sure what he's doing there other than to set up this next kind of weird bit there where after this whole match here that's been going on for 15, 20 minutes or however long it's been, Mankind has an idea. He's kind of looking around, and he decides to ask the ask the forklift driver in the most polite fashion, which drives Vince absolutely insane, if he could borrow the forklift for a minute.
Get out, please. Get out, please. He's saying, get out, please. What kind of a cretin is this man? He says, please. What's he going to do now? He's going to run over it. Mankind's going to run over Rock. That's what he's going to do.
But no, Vince, no, he's not going to run over him. For you see, on a forklift, he can just lower the forks, on which there was a pallet. For some reason, the guy had a pallet full of beer kegs up in the air and just kind of had it hanging there, which seems incredibly unsafe. I know from my forklift operation working at PetSmart at the time that you're not supposed to have the forks up unless you're actually doing something with it. You're not supposed to just leave a pallet hanging. That is a definite safety hazard. So Mankind gets in, he lowers the forks down onto the prone Rock, thereby trapping him under a pallet that had these kegs on top. Now, the WrestleCrap guys named this one of the worst finishes or stupidest finishes ever. Honestly, it's not even the worst finish to a world title match in a major promotion that month, let alone of all time. I mean, you had a finger poke of doom less than a month earlier on January 4th with, you know, a dome stadium audience there that effectively ended up killing a promotion. This is really just harmless fun. I mean, it's kind of a comedy match here that we're doing. I mean, if you're at all paying attention, it's really kind of an elongated brawl slash comedy match. And honestly, I find it to be great fun watching it in retrospect. And I don't know, you can make an argument about them playing hot potato with the world title, constantly passing it back and forth here. But I don't think they damaged things too badly here. Everybody won from this match. Mankind wins the WWF title for a second time, and he holds the belt up and says, I did it, just as he had done in the Worcester Centrum about a month earlier. Vince McMahon wins here because he's exposed his product to a new audience. And this edition of Halftime Heat drew a rating of 6.6. So even higher than the usual Monday Night Raw rating, tuned in to see this very unique match. And as I've mentioned, The Rock may have been the biggest winner of all, because while yes, he was able to show his personality on a weekly basis since his heel turn in 1997 and leading the nation with all the catchphrases and this and that kind of stuff, here is this new audience, these new people coming in and seeing Dwayne Johnson the Man being kind of a comedian as a wrestler here. And he wasn't in movies at this point. There was no Scorpion King. There was no Fast and Furious. This, I think this is the absolute genesis of Dwayne Johnson, top ace, number one movie star in the world. It all started at this very point because it exposed him to a much greater audience. So I'm not going to quibble with the finish here, because every single person involved here got something out of it. And that's really what it's all about. And that's where I'm going to wrap up the show, because in the course of recording this over several days, we've had the worst mass shooting in American history, at least in modern history, the last however many years. We've lost Lance Russell, one of the most decent men in wrestling history, a legend of Memphis. And I have to say, as I've said before, I'm extremely jealous of people who got to grow up and watch Memphis wrestling on television and got to have Lance Russell as sort of their wrestling dad on TV narrating the action for them. We've lost Tom Petty, a guy whose music carried me through some times in my teenage years. I'm thinking the Wildflowers album. And yes, he had other work that was probably even better than that. But when it hits you in that sweet spot when you're 14, 15, 16 years old, it makes a big difference. And we also lost Maury from Goodfellas. I don't know if he ever got paid on that, but, you know, we have to laugh some. I'm terribly sorry for laughing at a man's death, but the guy was 89. I don't even remember the actor's name there. The YouTube comments are actually disabled for this video, so this person definitely does not want YouTube comment theater for this. So instead, with great reluctance, I announce the return for a second week of Vinny Vegas Corner. Now, last week, I was 1-2, and it looked particularly bad during the 1 p.m. games where I had picked the Atlanta Falcons over the Buffalo Bills after praising the Bills to the hilt. So this week, I'm going to try to keep it simple and have an actual logic behind the three games that I will be picking here. My first pick is the Carolina Panthers at 3-1 are visiting the also 3-1 Detroit Lions. The Lions are favored by 2.5 points, and I will go with the team from Motown. And there's a simple explanation why. Yes, Carolina went into New England and upset the Patriots 33-30 this past Sunday. And that's quite an accomplishment to win a game in Gillette, despite the fact that it is the second Patriots home loss of the season. However, there's been a thing over the years that I've noticed, and it's that teams that play the Patriots generally don't do well the week after, either because, you know, they're tired or worn down, or if in the case of beating the Patriots, it can be a bit of a letdown the following week. And Detroit could very well be 4-0 after getting maybe a little bit robbed in that game against the Falcons. And seeing that they're only giving 2.5 points, less than a field goal, I am going to take that and run with it. Our next matchup is the Sunday night game, which is the Kansas City Chiefs at 4-0, the only undefeated team remaining in the National Football League, going into Houston to face Deshaun Watson and the Houston Texans, who I proudly drafted in my wins pool, hoping that the Texans might stumble upon a quarterback, more likely Watson, but who knows, maybe Tom Savage could have worked out. Well, obviously, that's not the case. And I've just been blown away with what Watson brings to the position with his escapability. It reminds me very much of kind of an early Michael Vick. And yeah, you know, it's been a short, you know, sample size so far, but you have the Chiefs here who didn't look good for much of the game against Washington this past Monday night. And the Texans are getting 1 point at home, so home dog alert there. If you go with home underdogs, you would tend to do pretty well. And I think the Texans will come out strong in this game and end the undefeated season of the Chiefs. So I like Houston plus one against KC. And for my last pick, I'll go to the other Monday night game, although it was more difficult to find a line on this game. For the 2-2 Minnesota Vikings, who don't really seem to have a quarterback or even now a running back after some injuries, we'll be visiting the Chicago Bears at the Soldier Field Spaceship in Chicago. And I think the Bears, after seeing them against Atlanta earlier in the season, I have the sense that they can be a pretty feisty home team, especially, you know, if they're in a position where a team is playing down to their level and is keeping them in the game, I could see the Bears sneaking out a whole bunch of wins here. And this is not a 3-13 or a 4-12 Bears team that, you know, for all their issues at the quarterback position right now, I think this is a team that could sneak out 7 or 8 wins, believe it or not, just on the basis of I think that they're good enough, honestly. And seeing as though they're getting 3 points in the line that I found against the Minnesota Vikings, who are going to kill me in my wins pool once again, except for the fact that I'm already getting killed by having both the Chargers and 49ers, who have 0 wins between them. But in any event, I will be taking the Chicago Bears plus 3 at home against the Minnesota Vikings. Now for next week's show, I'm going to return to some WWF action from the 1980s, but this time going to visit Wrestling Challenge from March 12th, 1989. So checking in with Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby the Brain Heenan for the first time in 30 episodes, so I figure that's a good interval to finally return to that. And there's really no particular reason why I would choose the March 12th, 89 episode of Challenge, other than there were a few things that caught my attention, a few fresh items to talk about. You know, I always wonder how I'm going to talk about guys who have come up on the show time and time again, but I've never had an Ultimate Warrior match on Greetings from Allentown, so I'll have one of those as he leads up to his match against Rick Rude at WrestleMania 5. The Fabulous Rougeau brothers, under the tutelage of Jimmy Hart, with their awesome tune that they would come to the ring on, and that wonderful gimmick. We have the Twin Towers in action facing a young tag team that would go on to do some things in the wrestling business. And also, there are commercials on that video that caught my attention because it is taken from the Boston feed. So this is probably the exact thing that I was watching in 1989 as it was happening, because it was taken right off Fox 25, and there were a few ads on there that, well, I'm gonna need to discuss some of the things that I saw on them. And of course, that is also the same weekend as a Saturday Night's Main Event that aired on NBC, so I'm sure that'll come up as well. The comments from Hulk Hogan and Macho Man Randy Savage in there. As I said, the Rashomon effect lead up to WrestleMania 5. So do tune in then for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
It's mild.